There we go. Hello. I'm packing my bags ahead of a summer break, and you may be too. But can you keep your eye off markets and economies? Can you be confident that things will tick along? Or are there just too many variables up in the air threatening to come down with a bump? Join me for answers from an expert pre-holiday panel. I'm Richard Edgar, and this is Rich Pickings, Fidelity's Asset Allocation Podcast. Well, with me today are Steve Ellis, Fidelity's Global Chief Investment Officer for Fixed Income, Anna Stubnitska, Global Macroeconomist, and Equities Portfolio Manager Rosanna Bucheri. Welcome to you all.
Hi, Richard.
Hi, Richard.
Thank you for having us.
Now, Anna and Steve, we last spoke on this podcast in March, just after the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, when things seemed very uncertain. 3 months on, the sky hasn't fallen on our heads. Equity markets are still on the rise, while inflation is high and rates keep on rising. Now, Anna, this isn't the way that things are meant to pan out in the textbooks, is it?
That's right. We have learned that actually policymakers can be very effective at dealing with troubles. And so far, at least, they have been effective at separating macroprudential instruments, so financial stability policies, from interest rate policies. We have moved towards a narrative that's dominating markets right now of a soft landing, no recession, and also that the policy transmission lags are either very long or very short, and we're yet to find out. So you're right, it's a very different environment from when we talked on this podcast after SVB.
So, Steve, would you agree that it's the macroprudential, the firefighting that has worked in this case? But I imagine you're a little bit more sceptical about the monetary policy side.
Well, yeah, no, I agree with Anna in that the BTFP, which is the policy that the Fed put in place as a, you know, emergency backstop for bolstering reserves, you know, that certainly calmed the storm, if you like. But I don't think SVB, that whole reserve loss and the duration mismatch on their balance sheets has gone away, Richard. I think we were having this discussion the other day. I think it's like the savings and loans crisis, where this, you know, end to end, that was a long process. And, you know, we're just at the start of this. I think, you know, the big problem again is the duration mismatch because of the inversion of the curve. And, you know, really the problem has been alleviated in the short term because of the backstop, but also, you know, what you've seen is a, you know, rather than the reserve depletion from the loss of the regional banks, the market's been kind of liquefied by the rundown in the reverse repo facility, which was $2.5 trillion down to $2 trillion now, and there's kind of a loss of liquidity which has been swilling around, which I think is partly responsible for asset markets doing so well. So This is not going to go, especially with that inversion of the curve persisting. I think we'll probably see some more skeletons coming up in the next few quarters or so.
Rosanna, coming to you, you focus on the US, obviously, in buying equities. What is the picture that you're picking up from the companies that you cover on the ground?
A lot of company tells you that it smells already like a recession and a slowdown since the second half of last year. The thing is that in the numbers, inflation plays a little bit of a trick, so you don't see it. But hence, the setup is actually very bullish for equity, and in a certain way explain how the market is behaving. Because the slowdown, and it's mainly in terms of destocking, and resizing of the capacity, for example, we've seen it in semiconductor, in chemical companies, as really starting in second quarter of last year. So we're actually at the end of it. And that's why, you know, from the company, the bad news is already behind us. And we're actually in this point where we are 1 or 2 quarter into this cyclical upturn.
So you're actually diametrically opposed to the view that Steve just set out. So he thinks there's trouble ahead, whereas you're saying, no, we've got the bad news, that's already baked in.
Well, you've seen, for example, in semiconductors, companies are burning cash, but, you know, they enter the period, the industry is a better setup in terms of the concentration, the balance sheet were in better state. So yes, they're burning cash, but they can withstand that. Chemicals, we've seen a flurry of profit warning already in Europe and in the US. but the company are telling you, you know, it's because of destocking. There was a lot of overcapacity built in China. Now the market is self-correcting. And we know from history that destocking phase can last two or three quarters, even if we think that this time they're lasting 4 to 5 to 6 quarters, we're almost at the end of it. The only area that you know is probably linked to what Anna and Steve were saying, that we have not yet seen tangible evidence of bad news in commercial real estate is very much linked then to bank lending. Only in these quarterly numbers that we are just going through from the bank, we are starting really a ramp up in terms of provisioning for commercial real estate, mainly focusing on the office space.
Okay, well, that is one of the warning signs, isn't it? So perhaps we'll come to that in a few minutes. But I want to come back to you, Anna, and get your take on all of this, because the threat of recession has been looming over us since, you know, before the start of this year. I know that you and the rest of the macro team have been discussing your forecasts this week. Given that, you know, this is the sword of Damocles that hasn't yet fallen, are we immune to a recession, do you think?
I don't think we are immune to the recession. And in fact, for now, we are maintaining our conviction that we will see a recession. And we have a high conviction on the end point, that this is where we're heading, than on the timing. We have pushed the timing out already from middle of this year to end of this year and potentially 2024. We are investigating why we are seeing this continued resilience. And we think that one of the key reasons, again, is those COVID-related distortions, such as excess savings, both for the corporate sector and for the consumer. There are various views on where excess savings are now across the board. So as we look over the next few months, we think this tailwind is fading. And at the same time, those policy tightening transmission lags are quite long. We're already seeing that in the credit channel. And in fact, that stress in the financial system we saw in March was one of the warning signs. There is a slow-moving credit crunch going on, which we can see from a number of different indicators, whether it's survey-based or actual indicators, that credit crunch is slow-moving through the credit channel. And we are expecting that this policy tightening will start hitting the real economy over the next few months. This is very much out of consensus right now, but we maintain that view.
I was going to come to that because you're saying it's a high conviction. You've pushed back when you think it's going to happen, the recession, but you do think it's going to happen. And it's something like 80% or something like that is the forecast that you have, your certainty.
80%, yes, yeah. For a cyclical recession, which is not a very deep recession, perhaps relatively shallow, moderate recession, not too long, but nevertheless, growth contraction over a few quarters.
If I may add, I think because Anna touched on two very important things that are different from other period of recession and slowdown. One, that the corporate, above all in the US, they've entered this very difficult period, actually well equipped with very solid balance sheet. And the consumer that we know, for example, in the US is really the big driver of the GDP in the US, also entered this very tough period with interest rate rising in very, very good condition. We have never seen so much cash that was injected directly into the pocket of the US consumer like we have seen in 2020 and 21. Unemployment is very low. You know, there are 1.6 job for every unemployed person. Almost 86% of the employable population is employed. So the consumer is holding up. She is running down the savings that have accumulated during COVID. But with unemployment so low and wages that are increasing year after year, you know, the consumer can hold up pretty well.
So that's bolstering the softish landing. It's not quite a soft landing, Anna, is it? Because you're still talking about a recession. But certainly it's maybe the reason why things have been prolonged. The good news has been prolonged.
Yeah, this is why we think the effects of monetary policy tightening have not shown up yet in a more pronounced manner in the real economy. Because of the tightness of the labor market, because of this strength of the consumer, the Fed and other central banks have to do more. Not just in terms of hiking rates further from here, but keeping them there for a long time. And so we think that because of this strength, in a way, monetary policy has to get tighter to tame inflation, and that will have to produce growth damage for the economy.
Well, Steve, let me come to you on that, because that sounds like the sort of thing that you've been talking about in the past of central banks overdoing things, over-tightening, and the damage that they might cause in their wake.
Yeah, I think that's the irony, to be honest, is that the narrative has changed in the last few months or so, in that at a time when inflation expectations, and there's evidence now coming through that inflation isn't sticky, but it's actually coming off harder than expected. And you can see that, you know, and when you look at the kind of forward-looking indicators, whether it's things like money supply growth or supply chains or whatever, you know, we could even be talking about deflation at the end of the year. There's lots of political pressure as well. You know, you can see that, for example, Jeremy Hunt in the UK, Chancellor, was pressurizing supermarkets into, you know, not just holding prices steady, but cutting prices. There's just at a time when inflation expectations are now, you know, right near the bottom, and inflation is coming lower. Central banks have gone the opposite way. They're not taking their foot off the brake. They're stamping down even harder. And I think they're emboldened by the fact that markets have actually held up. So they're kind of almost justifying the need. And also, as mentioned, the labor markets are still, at the least on the surface, looking relatively tight. But they feel emboldened here. Nothing's cracked so far. So therefore, they keep going. And I think that's the problem here for markets, is that central banks do over-tighten. You know, the Fed are likely to hike one more time to take policy rates to 5.5%. You know, I would say we'll probably look back at this and think 5.25%, which is where we are right now, we were already at very restrictive policy rates and the Fed overdid it. And I think that's what markets, in the next coming months, will focus more and more on, that actually those last remaining few rate hikes were not necessarily needed. And those will have to be, you know, priced out. The market will have to look at doing a U-turn and or, you know, changing course on balance sheet expansion on QT.
So that's a worrying outlook. So far, equity markets have ignored that risk. The S&P just keeps heading higher and has beaten a lot of expectations. What about credit markets? Because they're normally the first, like you know, as a CIO in fixed income, to be spotting the dangers. Have credit markets taken fright?
Let me just start by saying that, you know, we can all talk about the breadth in equity markets and so on. And so the underlyings are, you know, whilst the headlines might be that equity markets have been rising more recently, the underlying fragility is there when you look at the breadth. Credit markets aren't buying it, right? They're not buying it. We're seeing, when we look at credit spreads year to date, we're pretty much where we started the year. So US high yield, for example, we're trading about 390 basis points, and investment grade about 130 basis points. So not far away from where we started. We haven't seen that broad-based contraction in credit spreads more recently, as equity markets have been going higher. So credit is not buying. It's saying, hang on a minute, this doesn't feel right at all. But when you look at credit markets here, you know, the question is just how, if we do get recession, whether it's going to be a hard landing, soft landing, and so on. I've mentioned many times that, you know, high yield markets are not braced for a recession at all. You know, you've got default, the kind of implied default, which is priced in to that spread of, let's call it 400 basis points for argument's sake, on US high yield. It's just, you know, it's way too low. It's about, you know, 4.5% or so in the next 1 year. And, you know, we could see a much harder landing than that. So you just don't get any cushion there at all. So I would say markets have been very much lulled into this false sense of security, in that I think what's causing this is that, you know, Anna mentioned that, you know, the credit markets, the extension of credit, we're seeing a credit crunch in the real economy. But what we're seeing is massive credit expansion in the sort of financial area. There's huge kind of expansion, interbank expansion of credit. Banks are lending to others looking, you know, willing to invest in the AI phenomenon. And, you know, so that I think that's what's happening is there's a ton of liquidity going around in the interbank market. And that's feeding its way into asset markets. And therefore, asset, you know, equity markets have been in relatively well. But underlying, I think it's a lot more sinister.
Rosanna, is that the picture that you're seeing with the companies that you cover? I know that credit is drying up for small cap companies. What about the larger cap ones in the States? Are they worried about this, or have they still got this cushion that you were talking about at the beginning, so that they don't need to worry?
Well, they still have a cushion. I mean, we've seen a few companies that, you know, that have to refinance that. They sort of highlight the fact that interest costs are going up. But as always, you know, there are always the kind of companies that didn't renegotiate that. What I like to think is that if you think about, you know, we have been through this period of 10 years with very, very low interest rate. If you were a sensible chief financial officer of a company, you had tried to renegotiate and lengthen the duration of the debt as much as possible and locked a very low interest rate. And that's what we have seen. And above all, that was a trend that was accentuated at the beginning of the COVID when still the interest rates were low, because chief financial officers sort of panicking, they wanted to restructure the balance sheet and make sure that they had put the house in order. And they are benefiting, you know, most of the company, they are benefiting right now. It is true that if you are a company that have not renegotiated debt, or you are more dependent on the short-term debt, interest rate costs are going up, and they're going to impact the cash flow. But like I said, overall, when you step back and you look at the overall health of the U.S. corporate, they are pretty good. You're always going to find the company that was too much leveraged and entered the period with too much leverage. But it's very, very punctual. It's not something that can be seen across the system.
That's where you get to pick and choose amongst the companies, of course. Anna, what about you? What are you watching in this particular area that either causes you concern, or some of the comfort that Rosanna's talking about?
Well, first of all, what we're seeing from bank lending surveys is that credit standards have tightened, again, across developed markets, not just the U.S. We didn't see really large tightening after the SVB and related stress in the financial system. So there was some tightening, but not too large. And I think that gave some comfort perhaps to markets. But even with the tightening credit standards that we have seen so far, if we look at actual credit, we are likely to see actual credit contracting by the end of this year. So there is a lag, but we're already seeing that feeding into actual credit numbers. And then from the demand side, also all the surveys point to much weaker demand for mortgages, but also consumer loans, auto loans, credit cards, etc., again, across the board. So the consumers are also demanding less credit, and again, that will be reflected in actual numbers. So we do think the slowdown is happening through the credit channel. One thing I would say to Rosanna's point is that the long period of interest rates being at zero effective bound meant that the transmission mechanism for monetary policy has changed, and it has potentially become longer because companies and households have locked in credit and mortgages at very low rates. And this is something that is very concerning for the Bank of England, for example. They have talked about it on a number of occasions, that given that a lot of mortgages have been moved to fixed rates, that means that effectively, economy has become less sensitive to that monetary tightening. So ironically, they have to do more. But also at some point, when these mortgages roll over, and this is happening over the next few months, but also 2024, 2025 in the UK, when the maturity wall for corporates becomes higher. I'm sure Razan is watching that in the US from 24 onwards. This is where we can start really feeling that tightening feeding through. But for sure, the nature of the transmission mechanism has changed. And that's something that we are doing a lot of research on and watching very closely.
I look forward to hearing about that when you're ready, Anna. In the meantime, we're all looking for the weather vanes that will point which way things are going to go, or perhaps when, which is the key point that you've been talking about. And one leading indicator of market stress can be seen in the chemicals sector, where companies have delivered, as you mentioned, Rosanna, a slew of poor quarterly results. Now, chemicals companies supply the raw materials to hundreds of other sectors, so they're often the canary in the coal mine for falling end consumer demand. Could the disappointing results be a sign of this elusive recession? My colleague Nina Flitman has been talking to three analysts who cover the sector from different asset class perspectives, and here she is finding out more.
Now, Mike Dolan, you are a director of research in our fixed income team. Why is there such a focus on what's happening in the chem sector recently?
There's a number of reasons. I mean, firstly, chemicals are pervasive, right? They're everywhere. They reach every end segment and so are seen as a good barometer for the global economy. Also, I think it's in focus because there seems to be an element of surprise here in that a lot of companies had flagged that destocking was coming to an end, but that apparently has not been the case, and that's why we're seeing these warnings coming through.
I'm also joined by Liz Brockway, who covers the market from a private credit perspective. Where have we seen weaknesses on the private side?
Previously, when we've seen destocking, we always see resilience in certain of the end markets like personal care, healthcare, pharma, and agriculture. So in all honesty, we've seen it across the whole space, which has been quite shocking, which just speaks to how much inventory is in the system and that it's not just that weakness in the end market demand.
Also here is equity analyst Panpan Shao. Now, Panpan, how long do you think the effects of what we've seen in 2021, 2022, those supply chain issues, are going to be felt?
What we've seen is that over the course of 2021, so right after COVID, companies throughout the value chain all suffer from supply chain disruptions. So everyone is thinking of adding safety stocks so throughout the chain. For chemical companies, the sales, the revenues is doing really, really well. But then now it's basically a reverse of what's been going on for the last almost 18 months. And then if you look at the end market, the inventory to sales ratio are really, really high for certain end markets such as electronics or consumers. Inventory to sales ratio is even above, it's sort of reaching 20 years high. So yeah, I guess it will take a while for this inventory to wind down. And then also right now it's compounded by end market weakness.
How does this compare with when we've seen previous cycles in terms of how long this trend is lasting?
I've covered it for a long time. The obvious comparison is the 2008 global financial crisis, where we had 9 months of destocking there, and that was unprecedented at that time. But now we've already gone through 9 months in this cycle.
I think to that point, we've seen some of our companies report that when you look through to their end clients, some of them started this destocking cycle sitting with stock of about 9 months, where they usually carry about 1 to 2 months safety stock prior to the supply chain issues that Panpan was talking about. So it's really difficult to say how long it's going to take before they run out of the normal safety stock and then start stocking up again.
Mike, can I ask, how optimistic are we that this is all down to the destocking trend? And you mentioned, I think, how long this has been going on. How long before we actually start thinking this is about the weakness in the end markets completely and it's not really down to destocking anymore?
Well, I mean, I think there is some end market weakness, but as Panpan has highlighted, inventory levels are still elevated. And anecdotal comments from some of the companies, they've actually said that underlying demand is unchanged versus quarter one. So it seems that demand is not getting weaker for many companies. It really is just an inventory issue. But destocking has been going on since Q3 of last year, really started in August last year. And visibility is very low in these companies. 4 to 6 weeks is normal. So, I think Q2 is gone, obviously. and some of the outlook statements that we've seen for the rest of the year, where they previously had some optimism around growth, have now assumed that there's going to be no growth in the rest of the year, which points to certainly destocking through Q3 as well.
Pan, you're nodding. You agree with my point?
Yeah, I completely agree. And also, I think for certain end markets, for instance, I also cover agriculture, chemical companies. I met one of the company last week, and actually they said, so on the crop protection side, destocking may last even longer than end of this year, and then it may even last until Q1 next year. But then the company's visibility is really, really low.
That was analyst Tanpan Zhao with Mike Dolan and Liz Brockway, who were in conversation with Nina Flitman. And Anna, picking up on some of the points raised there, China is somewhere where we've been expecting a demand surge. And in fact, earlier this year, there was a rather odd term being bandied around, revenge spending, to describe the pent-up demand from consumers. But that picture looks very different now, doesn't it?
That's right. China's reopening did not follow the template of what we saw in the US and in Europe and the UK for a number of reasons. One of them was that actually the fiscal support wasn't as strong in China. And so as the economy reopened, we have seen the pickup in outbound tourism, in demand for luxury, high-end luxury products. But we have not seen broader pickup in consumption overall. Consumer confidence remains low. The property sector is the main drag. We have not seen large policy support, both on the monetary and also on the fiscal front. And in fact, we do not expect that to happen. We think that recovery is going to be gradual. It remains fragile. It's more of a muddle through story from here as the policymakers continue to address structural challenges. They're not looking to boost the economy a lot in this cycle.
So muddled through, you're not writing off China yet, are you?
We're not. We think that growth will continue, and we think that it's likely that they will be able to hit the growth target this year. In fact, we're expecting 5.5% growth for this year, given the base effect. So we are expecting activity to continue picking up. We're expecting consumption and services sector in particular to continue supporting the recovery. We are seeing some very targeted policy support, and that could become a bit broader. But again, it's mainly aiming at supporting the property sector, boosting that consumer confidence. But again, not a huge stimulus like the one that we saw after the global financial crisis.
And coming back to, well, back to Europe, actually, and inflation, Steve's already touched on this a little bit, but there are very different challenges in the UK and Europe. So what do you see as the main role of the ECB and the Bank of England now, and how they manage things, given that particularly in the UK, inflation has, until very recently, seemed much stronger?
Well, the latest reading gave a lot of relief to two markets, and I'm sure Governor Bailey in particular, because it has showed that inflation is starting to recede. But the challenge is that it has to be a trend from here over the next few months. And also, we are seeing inflation expectations still very elevated across the board, particularly in the UK. So the BOE has to continue being hawkish and sending those hawkish messages of determination to gain some credibility. It's fair to say they have lost some credibility given their track record in taming inflation in this cycle, and they will have to continue being hawkish. And again, that's why in that trade-off between letting inflation run a little bit hot but not pushing economy into the recession, we think they will have to ultimately choose more tightening, getting inflation under control, which means that we will see a recession here in the UK as well.
Steve, what would Andy Bailey have to do at the Bank of England to win your confidence again?
Look, I think central banks are fighting last year's battle, no more so than in the UK. And I know that inflation appears to have been sticky up until now. But what I find astounding really is really the path of interest rates that priced into forward markets, into SONIA markets. And When you look here, so when policy rate's at 5% now, we've got another 100 basis points or so of hikes between now and the end of this year. And then into next year, there's very little in the way of easing, if at all, about, you know, 10 basis points or so. Now, I find that astounding. I think, you know, in the first place, to get another 100 basis points of hikes from the Bank of England, so that would take us to 6%. And to hold rates at those levels for another year, and even by 2025, there are no, there are very few in the way of interest rate cuts. Actually, there's more in the back end of 25. But and it's the same to a certain extent in the ECB as well, in that there's another one hike of 25 basis points or so priced, and then in the next meeting, and then for the 1 year ahead, you're pretty much at the same level. Now, compare and contrast to what's happening in the US, where the market thinks that the Fed are going to over-tighten to a certain extent, and there's going to be a policy U-turn in that they'll have to ease interest rates into next year. I find it astounding that the Bank of England would keep rates at 6% and hold them there, given the resets on mortgages, given I think it's a more interest rate sensitive economy than in the US, and the same with Europe as well, which is already in recession. I think that's where the biggest misprice is.
Well, I'm feeling somewhat sensitive to interest rates myself as my own mortgage comes up next year. So I hope you're right, Steve. Rosanna, you wanted to come in.
Going back to a point that was raised about the structure and the sensitivity for the US consumer, there is one thing it's important to point out. After the great financial crisis, all the system was obliged to switch to fixed rate mortgages. So effectively, it's true, the U.S. consumer is much less sensitive to swing in mortgage rate, because a lot of people that bought their house in the last 10 years have locked themselves a very low interest rate for the next 10 to 15 years. So it's correct that we have this lengthening of the impact that high interest rate have on the U.S. consumer. And the fact that the U.S. consumer had so many savings, it means that he has not been using a lot of consumer credit, because that's another channel where you can have quite a high impact of high interest rate. We have just started seeing this year in the numbers of the bank a little increase in use of revolving credit. And clearly, you know, we needed to pay attention of the low-income population. But at the same time, so with the job market so strong, you know, I have difficulties in sort of imagining the U.S. consumer under stress this year.
No, but I think this is where this dilemma is. And I don't agree with Steve on... I think on his views on the inflation path, I don't think we're going to see significant disinflation and even deflation in coming months. But because of this low sensitivity of the economy and of consumers, central banks have to do more. They have to hike more to get inflation down. And so that's the whole irony of the situation, is that a lot has been done to smooth out the shocks to the economy, but because of low sensitivity, now they have to do more. Sure, if inflation starts falling very rapidly and it goes to target, I think they will do a very quick course correction. And to a point, Steve, markets will have to price interest rate cuts more significantly next year. That is, if you see inflation going quickly to target. But if not, they will try to keep rates potentially higher for longer. But we have never seen in the history that we have of central banks, particularly independent central banks, such a smooth path for rates. They keep rates high until something breaks, and then they have to cut very quickly. So whatever market is pricing, this trajectory is very unlikely. Whatever view you have from here, it's unlikely to be smooth.
Yeah, but just to go back on that point, so I think you're right. I think central banks are having to over-tighten here. My argument for a reversal here, particularly on QT, I think they'll probably have to abandon balance sheet reduction here at some stage. But my argument for rate cuts into next year is not based on inflation coming back towards trend. I think that the over-tightening they're doing, and they've done already, is going to cause something to snap. And as you mentioned, you know, it's the credit markets. I think that's where you're seeing the tightening in loan standards, and you know, we've got refinancing coming up. It's going to be, I think that it's really going to cause some damage. And so, but they only get the green light if inflation is back to somewhere close to target, which I do think is going to happen. But I think that that's my biggest concern, is the over-tightening causes something to snap here. But it's not necessarily, you know, about the inflation coming back to target.
I feel like throwing in the journalistic cliche here, only time will tell. But there's lots of discussion still to be had, which unfortunately we'll have to wait till next time because we're almost out of time. But we've still got time to play the Rich Pickings parlor game, hot cakes and hot potatoes. What would you buy, like a hot cake, or drop like a hot potato? Rosanna, it's your first time, so I'm going to invite you to go first. What's your hot cake? What are you buying like hot cakes?
Everything apart from tech. No, but it's true. You know, to go back to the point that Steve was making on the breadth of the market, this year has been very, very peculiar. In 27 years of managing money, I've never seen a market so much concentrated in some name. And listen, maybe there's going to be some justification about what is going to come out of this AI, even if I have a little bit of difficulties in sizing the revenue opportunity for a lot of the company that have gone up. But when you look at the rest of the market, it's practically done nothing, and it's been very pleasing to see the month of June and July, where finally we have seen a little bit more breadth in the market, and there are plenty of sectors that are still trading well below the 20-year average in terms of whatever kind of valuation that you want to look at. And the kind of sectors that I was mentioning before, where we are already seeing correction in the stock price and correction in the numbers, like semiconductor, chemicals, and I can throw it a little bit also, the financial, are very great hunting grounds.
Great hunting grounds. There you go. All right. Thank you very much. Very briefly, what are your hot potatoes? What would you drop? I presume the tech stocks.
Yeah, because you know, you really need to have a lot of faith on the next 10 years or 20 years of these high top line revenue. And you know, they're quite big, this company. I have a little bit of difficulties even mathematically to sort of make the numbers.
Oh dear. Okay. Thank you very much. Steve, your hot cakes, please.
Oh, so hot cakes, I would say keep it simple here, and I'll stick with my thinking on, you know, keeping to investment grade type of, you know, interest rate sensitive types of instruments here, just ready to price in those interest rate cuts. Basically, I think for the second half of this year, I think duration is going to be the trade as recession risks do rise, and we see that there's over tightening from central banks. So I'd be long duration. And I would express that through, say, dollar investment grade, global ag types of products. I think for hot potatoes, I'm anything sort of AI related, any kind of anything that's caught in the euphoria of AI, which, you know, we all done our reading on this. And as much as we'd like to hope that this is going to be transformational and so on, I'm a huge skeptic. And I guess if I'm wrong, humanity is going to be wiped out anyway. So we won't be around to see whether it is a hot potato or not. So.
Great. So we lose-lose.
Right. Yeah, imagine ChatGPT doing this podcast. It wouldn't be as interesting exactly. And insightful.
It certainly wouldn't. Anna, what though are you interested in at the moment in terms of your hotcakes?
I wanted to use our multi-asset team core asset allocation views, and it's a bit similar to what Steve said. Overall, we remain cautious on risk assets and credit in particular, but within credit, we like high quality credits and also emerging market debt, because a number of emerging markets started hiking rates earlier, and now they're ready to start cutting rates, and that favors them in the EMD universe. So these are hot cakes and hot potatoes on the other side, weaker DM corporates, weaker quality credits.
Lovely. Thank you very much indeed. And that's it for this episode. Thank you to Rosanna Bukeri, Steve Ellis and Anna Stupnitska for joining me, to Nina Flitman and our analysts, and of course to you for listening. As ever, you can read more analysis from Fidelity's experts on your local Fidelity website or at fidelityinternational.com. The producer today was Holly Eastman, with technical support from Canon Blitz and Connor Bailey. We'll be taking a short break over the summer, but we'll be back in your feeds in September. Until then, from all of us at Fidelity, goodbye.
This podcast is for investment professionals only and should not be relied upon by private investors. This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is intended only for the person or entities to which it is sent. It must not be reproduced or circulated to any other party without the prior permission of Fidelity. The value of investments can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. For other important legal notices, please visit your local Fidelity website.